Tonight on Arena, we've been watching The Assassin, The Narrow Road to the Deep North and Untamed, listening to Madonna, Paul Weller, We Are Scientists and Jade Bird. All of them are up for review. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we will start with our TV reviews as usual on a Friday evening. The Narrow Road to the Deep North, five-part BBC drama, also showing on RTE, co-production, I do believe, which is also available on the player. The series is adapted from Richard Flanagan's Booker Prize-winning novel. Jacob Elordi stars as the young Dorrigo Evans and an Australian surgeon, while Ciarán Hinds plays the older character. We follow his life in the present, as he is publishing a book, as well as his harrowing time as a World War II prisoner of war, and earlier and present day forbidden love affairs, it has to be said. The Assassin is a six-part series on Prime Video, stars Katie Hawes as Judy, retired hit woman living on a Greek island. Her estranged son Edward, Freddie Highmore, arrives seeking answers about his father. Judy's dangerous past resurfaces and she is reluctantly dragged back in, along with her son, to a lot of danger. But none of the bullets hit her at all, even though there are thousands flying at her. Untamed is a Netflix series set in the rugged wilderness of Yosemite National Park in the US. It follows National Park Service agent Kyle Turner, played by Eric Bana, taciturn character, haunted by tragedy in his past, fond of a drink. Very unusual, that, for a detective or an agent, isn't it? And as he investigates a mysterious murder with, guess who he's got alongside him? A rookie cop, Naya, played by Lily Santiago. He uncovers dark secrets tied to the park and his own past. Sam Neill and Rosemary DeWitt, co-star Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser, are with me in studio this evening to talk about all three. Let's start with The Narrow Road to the Deep North, BBC and RTE2, and indeed on the RTE player, adapted from the Booker Prize winning novel by Richard Flanagan. Epic story that follows this character, Dorrigo Evans, a surgeon, from his time in World War II to the 1980s, and even later than that, I think, as well. It really is a huge sweep, and it will take the full five episodes to tell this story, Chris.
It will, yeah. But it's handled beautifully. So as you say, there are three timelines here. The first is in 1941 in Syria, and you have Dorrigo Evans, played here by Jacob Elordi, who is a medical officer, you know, obviously never been to war before, and is finding out firsthand that war really is hell. And the series, directed by Justin Kurzel, as Justin always does with the filmmaking, he does not hold back here. This is a horrifying, harrowing depiction of war. And we also see Dorrigan before he left, you know, his last weekend in Tasmania with his uncle, portrayed by Simon Baker, how he was proposing to his rich girlfriend, Ella, but that he was actually falling in love with his uncle's new wife, Amy.
Or as he says himself, his uncle's far too young for
his wife. Yeah, there is this thing in this family that his uncle was married before, and they're not too happy with Keith basically marrying someone that's young enough to be his daughter. So those two timelines are unfolding, yeah. But we also have a third where Ciarán Hinds in the 1980s is playing Dorrigan, and has, you know, he's this respected decorated war hero. He's a respected surgeon. He's also about to publish a book, yeah, about his experience. And when we first meet him, he's promoting that book with help from his wife, Ella.
Right. And he's married to Ella, we know, yes, from at this point in time in the 1980s. Let's have a listen to a clip from that section of the series, because they intercut quite a lot. And it's easy to follow, I thought. Some intercuts can become very annoying, but it's so clear.
The editing is seamless.
Yeah, it's so clear which time frame you're in that it's not a problem. And this is Ciarán Hinds. Is Dorrigo Evans, and he's talking to a young journalist played by Annie Shapiro here. She's into the lion's den when she's talking to this man about his war history.
Dorrigo, you served in both the Middle East and Asia before the surrender. Tell me, how did it feel going from a soldier into a prisoner of war?
Feelings weren't as fashionable as they are now. We did what we were told.
It must have been scary, though.
More humiliating than anything. Letting yourself be incarcerated when others are fighting is hard for a soldier's spirit to accept.
What got you through?
I don't know. Luck, I suppose. Often luck is the only reason.
What do you recall most of that time? The time as a prisoner?
The strange, terrible, never-endingness of human beings. Though, in truth, our enemies were more monsters than men.
But what about us? Hiroshima, Nagasaki, are those not monstrous acts?
Yeah, we were forced to extreme measures.
Atomic bombs are beyond extreme, wouldn't you say, Mr. Evans? I've been to Japan. I've spoken to survivors who lost everything.
You've been to Japan, have you? That offers you some great insight. Believe me, young lady, you have no comprehension of war.
Because I'm a woman?
No, because you weren't there.
You weren't there, says Ciarán Hinds as Dárrigo Evans there in that scene from The Narrow Road to the Deep North. It's some extraordinary lines that he has in the midst of that clip, not least of which is the strange, terrible, never-endingness of human beings. The literary origins are very clear here in this realisation, Richard Flanagan's novel, obviously, Jen, but not in a way that you go, oh, stop quoting bits from the book.
No, it feels natural to those characters, and you can hear there really that it's about how in that time, he's wrestling with this idea of being considered even a war hero, or what does a war hero mean? And it's, you know, he doesn't want to be held in any high esteem for surviving the hell that he went through. And it's kind of, the series is wrapped up in ideas around fatalism. It's about the predestined course of life that feels suffocating as, as Dárrigo enters into this post-war marriage with his dutiful wife Ella, who comes from this family of influence, but also
her grandfather was part one of the people that was involved in writing the Australian Constitution. So she's from money.
Yes, and she has a job all ready to go set up for him the minute he comes home. But it's also about the fatalism of war, fatalism that marks, that makes outsiders indifferent to the realities of war. And this is where the series really leaves its mark in depicting Dárrigo's time after he was captured during the Battle of Java.
Yeah, because the whole series opens with an extraordinary, like a really grueling scene where they're all kind of just chatting around the place, and then somebody steps on a mine, and the outcome on a landmine, and the outcome is appalling and really difficult to watch. And that kind of prepares you for what's
coming. It does, and you have to be prepared.
You have
to be prepared, because Kurzel's, like Chris was saying, his previous work, you know, he has a tendency to err on the side of savagery. So you have to be prepared. Like, so you're there with these prisoners of war and they're forced to build the Burma, the Thailand, the railway, which is called, you know, the death railway was known as. And there is no easy way to talk about this. The depiction of their time under the Japanese soldiers is grueling. And don't go into this lightly, because it is a close-up examination of suffering, and it's about ideas about suffering, the futility of suffering, the suffering that these men endure. It's not a virtue. It's not some Christ-like thing to be held up. It's devoid of any true meaning. He is saying that war is nothing. It's a void. And we are the witnesses to the brutality and relentless. Now, when I say the violence is relentless, there is an episode that will make or break you, episode 4, and whether you want to continue or not.
But well, there only are 5. If you've gone as far as 4, you'll probably see it to the end.
You see these prisoners, they're like emaciated men, and they're kind of knockabout because they're Australian. There is this camaraderie to them, but it's really just to distract from the fact that they're in the worst time of their lives.
Yeah, there's a great,
and they're like boys then. They crumble like boys.
They are boys.
And it's so upsetting to watch that close up. And he doesn't spare you from seeing, you know, the malaria scars, the terrible surgery he has to perform. Yeah. It's all there.
Yeah, and well, they were boys for the most part. These were young, you know, Dárrigo was maybe 20 something, and he was kind of an officer in officer class, so he was a senior. And there is a wonderful scene where they're doing a version of Romeo and Juliet where Juliet is is acting his little heart out as Juliet, and then the other guy is kind of pulling the rug from underneath him all the time, saying, "I'm Australian, I don't understand the word you're saying." And there is great fun, but then this cruelty as well. We're in Bridge on the River Kwai territory, but not, there's nobody whistling Colonel Bogey's march as they go to make these railway lines. It really is dark, both to watch, to look at on the screen, and metaphorically.
Yeah, I was going to say that. But there's a spirit there with these guys. Like, even in the opening 5 minutes, the guys surrounding Jacob Elordi, they have these weird bets on to see which of the soldiers will survive the longest. And as you say, then when they're building the railway, that spirit kind of keeps them going. But by the time they're finished, it's almost gone. It is hard to watch. watch in more ways than one. I mean, it really is. It's beautifully edited. It's very well put together. There were times where I was thinking to myself, would this have made for a better film? But I think maybe the miniseries format does actually suit it. But
because of the novel aspect of it.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't mind the literary values. Like, it is quite artful and it's elegant, but then it's brutal when we go to the war section. But it's very hard to see at some point. And I get what Justin Kurzel is trying to do, because during the scenes where Jacob Elordi's Dorrigan is in Tasmania, you can practically feel the heat emanating from the screen. And this idea of, here is his last picture of happiness before he goes to war, and everything is bright and vibrant and full of hope. But there is a way, I think, of shooting the war scenes that you know, you still, it's like what you said, you still need to be able to see some of this.
I thought the war scenes were stunning.
You were happier with this,
I thought the war scenes were stunning. I think Sam Chiplin, who's the cinematographer, has to be commended here. There are shots, there's one particular shot where all the men, the prisoners, are looking up at one point, and it looks like a Goya painting. It's the darkest, most horrendous, horrific. They're, you know, all bones and giant eyes. And then it also kind of reminded me of the cinema, like the photography of Capa, like Robert Capa, the war photography as well. There's a lot in there. It's unflinching, but it is fused with this devastating tenderness between the men, even that you can see them huddled together at night, lying across from each other, gripping onto each other, wanting to be far away from there. And that's what makes those times with Dargo and Amy when they're there in Tasmania so beautiful as well. That love story really enriches the love story then between them.
I think you've both said, both Ciarán Hinds and what's his
Jacob
name?
Elordi.
Jacob Elordi is the young and old Dargo do great job. Any other standout performances? Just pick one quickly, Jen.
I mean, Odessa Young as Amy, I think she's...
Who's the young wife of the uncle. Yeah.
I think she's a stirring performance from her, because you know that she's very conflicted. She's seen her true love head off to war, and she's in a loveless marriage that she knows will crumble around her when he leaves.
Starts from you, Jen.
I think it's masterful television. I think it's about how we sit with memory, what we do with memory, what it means to us, what's the purpose of our lives. And it's sensuously done. It's dazzling, captivating. I have to give it 5 out of 5.
A full 5. And just standout performance outside of the two leads. Well, I think there are other lead performances, but that's the central character.
I quite like Simon Baker. He's had bigger parts, but I don't think
he's the uncle.
He's the uncle, Keith. Yeah, every time he comes in, he just lights things up, and he's quite effective and eye-catching in this. But Ciarán Hinds, it says a lot about Ciarán Hinds' performance that even with an Australian accent that doesn't always work, there's something about his performance. He captures so brilliantly this inner torment of a man and a former soldier who's seen the absolute best of what the world can offer, but also the worst of humanity. And he's so good that you just forget about the accent.
Stars.
I have problems with the visuals, but it is brilliant television. So 4 stars.
4 from you. All right. And it's available on the RT player. It'll be on RT2. And I think, I don't know what episode is currently shown on the BBC. It might even be over on the BBC. But anyway, you can watch it on the RT player, which is the more important detail in all of this. Let us move on then to The Assassin. Prime Video, latest for Katie Hawes, a vehicle where she, it's Mamma Mia meets James Bond. I like that, as Hawes plays former assassin Judy Greene. Just tell us about her character. I mean, the opening sequence is outrageous, and the next two sequences after it are equally outrageous, Jen.
Yes, the fans of Katie Hawes, she is back in Greece, but this is not the Dourles. So if you think it's going to be like that, it really isn't. There's no sleepiness here. So we're in Killing Eve territory here. We're in that smart alecky nature of something like Matthew Vaughn's Kick-Ass, or, you know, the stable of Marvel films you've seen recently. And it's from the brothers Harry and Jack Williams, and they're responsible for The Tourist, the Jamie Dornan show. And you can see that tonally, this is quite similar to it. Now, Julie Greene, who is this semi-retired professional assassin, is there an amateur assassin that we don't know about, though? She is going through it, we would say, and she has no time for anybody. And when I say this is a waspish performance from Katie Hawes, it really is. Like, she has the best lines. It's all about her hatred of human life. You see her just on the beach where she gets hit in the head by a beach ball or football, and then completely eviscerates the crowd
the
of teenagers.
Yeah.
And you get the sense that, you know, she's at the end of her tether, and then this call comes in where it's like, will you do one last job for us? Does she want to be sucked back in? Yeah. Of course she does.
Well, otherwise there's no series if she's not sucked back in. Let's have a listen to a clip. We should mention that the other important aspect of this is she has been estranged from her son, and it is not a case of like mother, like son. They are chalk and cheese.
They
really,
absolutely
Chris.
Are. Yeah. I mean, the opening scene of this is we see Julie when she was maybe about 20 and she has just taken out a tower of top notch baddies. Every single person
None
in
of
the
whom
building.
Can shoot straight. No. In every Bond film, she's perfect shot. She never misses.
Absolutely
but they all
true.
Miss her all the time.
Anyone who shoots at Julie, they never hit the target. But after doing this, takes out a pregnancy test and, you know, finds out that she is pregnant. And, you know, Edward wasn't part of the plan, and they are quite estranged. I don't think they've seen each other in 4 years.
Yeah.
But he arrives on the
island.
Well,
let's hear the moment when he arrives, and she's busy. She's been to the butcher's to get some food for her son, and here is the reaction.
Same room as last time?
Yeah, up the stairs. Same room.
All right, I'll just.
Hey, did you ever try that Wagyu beef?
What?
You mentioned it last time you were here. You said you'd read about it and
oh,
you wanted
yeah,
to.
Yeah, that was 4 years ago. I went vegan.
Oh.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Hey, sweet cheeks. It's been a while.
Damien, how the hell did you get this number?
Doesn't matter. Listen, I got a job for you.
Well, after 10 fucking years, you don't just... Whatever it is, I'm not interested, all right?
Well, you haven't heard it yet.
I'm retired.
Julie.
My son's here. This isn't a good time, okay?
The target's right on your doorstep, and they're a dangerous target. And if I had any...
You know, with the greatest respect, why don't you shove it all the way up your arsehole, Damien?
Who was on the phone?
My boyfriend.
Oh. Did you just tell him to shove it all the way up his arsehole?
Yeah, it's complicated.
Whatever you do in your own time's up to you. I didn't know you had a boyfriend.
So you definitely don't eat meat?
Vegans don't tend to.
Just make smart-ass quips.
If the lack of mammal flesh turns us into total bitches.
I'm just going to pop to the shop.
Fine, you really don't need to.
It's fine. Be right back.
Guess you've come a long way from Charlie in the Chocolate Factory, hasn't he? That's Freddie Highmore. Now vegan.
Yes.
Not vegan. Mm. Charlie would have eaten the meat if he was given it, that's for sure. You might remember him from that long, long ago. And there you're speaking to Keely Hawes playing his mother, Julie, retired assassin, who's Richard Dormer is on the phone trying to persuade
Damien.
Her as Damien. And because I was listening to him, whose voice is that? It was only when I saw the credits. Ah, that's whose voice it is. At any rate, I mean, and there's a great sense of humour in that. But I did wonder, Chris, are they trying a little bit hard in the humour?
Oh, God,
like in
yeah.
that, in the opening sequence, okay, we get all of that in the pregnancy test. That's funny. Then she belittles a fellow walking on the beach with his dog. Then she has a go at the children. Then she goes to the butcher's and has a go at all the locals in the shop. You thought one of those would have shown me that she's difficult and she doesn't get on well with anybody.
Yeah.
Like they're trying hard to be funny here.
They really are, and it really started to annoy me. And I think, you know, Freddie Highmore, maybe he has come a long way since Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, but isn't he supposed to be, like, aren't you supposed to improve as an actor? Because there were scenes
here where
I just thought someone else should have got this part.
Get better than Charlie.
I think if the majority of your scenes are going to be with someone as good as Keely Hawes, you need a great performer there. And I just don't think he's the right fit for this. I realise that he's supposed to be the opposite of Julie, but I think Freddie Highmore goes a little bit too far. He plays him as a bit of a drip. You know, he's too whiny and he's too, you know, you just don't buy.
Because he's a very successful, is it a girlfriend or
well,
wife?
He's
soon to be a wife.
And he's supposed to be a successful.
Fiance. And he's supposed to be a successful journalist.
Yeah, but he can't, you know, talk to his mom or ask her a question. He can't get any information out of his mom, because the other side of it is that he doesn't know who his father is. So that's where the Mamma Mia kind of aspect comes from. I found just tonally this was just all over the place, because you can go from something like kids throwing a ball at the back of Keely Hawes' head and she kicks it into the water to this poor Danish IT specialist in a Libyan prison having all of his fingers chopped off. And we see everything, and it's just, what are we going for here? And also the Libyan prison stuff, there's a subplot then in a London art college involving someone from Julie's past. There's Alan Dale from Neighbours in there playing a billionaire who has a successful mining company. It all gets a bit tangled and too complicated. Mm. It just should stick to that central premise. I love that central idea. Here's a
menopausal
assassin, woman who is trying to reconnect with her estranged son. Follow that. I think all the noise around this,
but
and also Freddie Highmore, doesn't work.
All the noise around it, it doesn't actually matter. That's the thing, I think, because all these characters, and there's so many characters in this, course, as Chris has said, there's a million different plots going on, but they're all caricatures. They're all they're not fleshed out as much as obviously Julie's
the
character
center,
is.
The central. And the other thing was that it struck me on the soundtrack. I mean, they are kind of having a go at the spy thriller genre. I mean, the music is straight out of the Bond songbook.
Yeah.
And they're having a go at that idea that he can go down into the village, that everybody gets killed except him.
Mm, you know? Spoiler alert. But I think that's the thing. It's the Killing Eve atmosphere, the Killing Eve vibe, where but they haven't got the script tight enough. They haven't got the storylines tight enough. It's a romp. There's a number of nonsensical things that happen in a flurry that they want to keep your eyeballs gripped. But, you know, there's nothing there to mull over, really. And I think I enjoyed just seeing the withering mother and her seemingly guileless son go at each other. And those scenes are the most enjoyable. And it lends it a more of an emotional register. But the bulk of the show is more concerned with the crash, bang, wallop action set pieces.
Stars from you on this one first, Chris.
I think it's too much of a cartoon for me. Love Keely Hawes, and I think she's having a great time here. But that execution, as you say, like all those influences, Kingsman, even True Lies, I just think it's an awkward combination. Right. I wanted it to be better. It's all over the place. So 2.5 out of 5.
2.5. What are you saying,
Jen? Yeah, it's disappointing. It disappointed me because it's very derivative. It's clogged up with cliches about espionage and geopolitical intrigues that we don't really care about. Keely Hawes, she's a massive talent and this doesn't do her justice, so it's 2.5.
And most of them are for her, I'm guessing, from what you're saying. Okay, so that's The Assassin, available on Prime Video. Finally then, Untamed on Netflix, is streaming on Netflix right now. We've a body, as I said, of a young woman found in Yosemite National Park. We have a taciturn cop with pain in his past. Let's not go too far into what exactly the pain in the past is, because they do drip feed you the information here over the first episode or two, certainly, that I got a chance to watch. But Eric Bana, he's very watchable as this Kyle Turner character, Chris.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think this is probably the best thing that he's done since The Dry, where, again, he was playing another, not The Dry, the Irish series. A very different...
For clarity.
A very different kind of setup, where he was playing, you know, the grizzled, troubled detective. And I think that sort of suits him. Here, he gets to play a sort of, you know, a troubled park ranger role. We open with a cliffhanger, where... woman has
look
there
what
you go.
You did there, Chris. But explain why it's a cliffhanger.
There are a couple of climbers at El Capitan, this 3,000-foot rock formation in Yosemite National Park, and they're almost to the top when someone falls to their death from above. But the big question is, did they really? Was this stranger who fell to their death, were they actually dead before they fell, where they pushed or thrown over? So that is for Eric Bana's cop character to figure out. But unfortunately, as you say, we won't say what has actually happened to him. There's tragedy in his past. He's no longer with his wife. He's drinking too much. And also his boss, Sam Neill, is a little bit worried about him and also a little bit worried about this case.
All right. Let's have a listen to a clip. I'll get you to explain. There is a young rookie cop who has the misfortune to be teamed up with the Eric Bana character.
Yes, and
although I think they'll probably get to like each other as the series goes on.
I hope I'm not
spoiling things.
But so she is Vasquez and she joins from LA and she is gung-ho ready to go. She's brought her 4-year-old son with her, and it's about her period of adjustment to the life there, but also she may or may not have a disgruntled ex-partner on her trail as well. So there's the secrets there, the depth that you see with Eric Bana's character as well. They're all hiding something from each other. And I think, you know, with her character, she does add that little bit of humour sometimes that you do need, because this is very brooding.
But there's great, I wouldn't call it knockabout between the two.
No, it's your typical fish out of water. Yeah. She's fish out of water and then he's showing her the ropes, and then it's the rookie and the senior and how they're going to deal with each other and rub up against each other.
There's a character mentioned in the clip that we're about to hear, a character called Milch, who's another one of the guys in the office who seems constantly sidestepping any kind of bit of work that he can sidestep. So here we will hear then Kyle Turner, the Eric Bana character. He gets a visit from the rookie park ranger, Naya Vasquez, played by Lily Santiago, to discuss the case that she has now been assigned to work on with him.
Captain Souter's orders. Park's pressuring him on the Jane Doe. He thought I might be able to help you speed things along.
You better at this than me?
Huh?
Huh?
No. I'm just saying.
How are you going to help me move faster then?
I didn't ask for this. We ran her prints through the system. No matches. Nothing in missing persons yet either. Went wide with her information, just a lottery ticket, but might get lucky.
What happened to Milch? He was senior ranger up there yesterday. Why isn't he doing this?
Captain Sauter gave it to me.
Sauter gave it to you, or Milch did?
Either way, here I am. Lucky me.
Did you get park employee records?
Requested, but don't have them yet.
Request again. It's possible Jane Doe's a park employee, but not a desk job. So we'll need names, date of birth. Have them check anyone who hasn't been to work the last few days.
There we go. Eric Bana is the very moody and broody. What's his name? Kyle Turner. And then Lily Santiago as the rookie park ranger, Naya Vasquez. It is very formulaic, this. You can see everything is kind of plotted and planted in scene one. If the gun is there in scene one, it's going to go off later on in episode one. But you have quite a cast. Sam Neill as the El Capitan, and Rosemary DeWitt.
Rosemary DeWitt is very good in this, and I think she is
I'm at a point where, and I don't want to spoil it on those who will be at this point, I'm at a point where we're not fully sure exactly what the relationship is between her and the Eric Bana character. So they're cleverly drip feeding this, but you have to be careful about what you say.
The difference between this and, say, something like The Assassin, I know the tone is totally different, but with this, they are handling their characters with care, and they want you to invest in them. So it's a slow burn. It has shades of that Mare of Easttown grittiness to it, and the wannabe style of the first season of True Detective. Now, it's not as good as either of those shows, but the performances, and especially that performance of Rosemary DeWitt, I have to say, is very strong. And I think it's, you know, Eric Bana is very good at portraying this ghost of a man who is grizzled and dissatisfied with life, and maybe gets reignited by Vasquez and her enthusiasm, which is a cliche. But I have to say, there is something gripping about those performances enough for you to go on. Story itself, there's red herring on top of red herring. And it just kind of, it fell apart for me towards the end. But there is enough there to keep you going, and there's enough there to keep you wanting to see how these characters develop and what happens to them, rather than what happens with the overall storyline.
Because that's what I found myself watching bits. And again, there were certain things. No, I know that that's not real. A certain thing that I was looking at, that I know that you're going to turn out to be this person.
Yeah.
So you can see things a mile off, but the performances were holding me. I thought, I'll go back and I'll watch more episodes.
The performances elevate proceedings. Bana is probably better here than he needs to be. It's always great to have Sam Neill around. It is quite formulaic, but you know, these kinds of shows, they're designed to, you know, they're an unusual sort of comfort, and however formulaic and silly and cliche they get, you know, they still pass the time very well. There is one thing I will say though, when armed with a Warner and Netflix budget, you would expect that these things at least look great. There are times where it's very, very obvious that a green screen or a digital backdrop is being used. And I just sat there watching the first couple of episodes saying out loud, go outside. Shoot these scenes outside.
Yeah, Eric Bana was doing a big abseil type of down the side of a cliff in the first episode. Yeah, you went about
it was
10
poorly
foot,
done.
You went about 10 foot down there at the very most.
It was poorly done, but stick with it, because I thought the first episode, again, we won't give away what the background
is.
But the first episode is a little bit manipulative. The second one's a bit wobbly, but then it settles, and then it becomes something very entertaining. If you pay attention, you'll know where it's all going. Yeah. But it passes the time nicely, as I say.
All right, passes the time nicely. Will not be getting put on the poster, don't think, Chris. Stars from, I'll go to you first on this one, Jen.
It's not original. There is a flair here.
That won't be going on the poster either.
There's a flair here of something, and I think it's because of the way that they develop those characters. Yeah. And that's a good enough story for me. I wanted to watch all of those characters and how they interacted. So it's a solid three.
A solid three. It's not original. There's a flair here of something. Yeah. What are you saying, Chris?
I'm saying, in a word, grand. I can have that one for the poster. Right. I suspect we're going to see Bana playing lots of these kinds of roles in the future, and I'm okay with that. So three stars.
Three stars, yeah. I think it would be in total accord with you on that particular one. And I am looking forward to getting back to the rest of The Narrow Road to the Deep North, but I know I'm going to have to take a deep breath before I do that. The Narrow Road to the Deep North can be viewed, as I said, RT2 and the RT Player. The Assassin, streaming on Prime Video. Untamed, available on Netflix. My thanks to Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon. We'll be right back. And so to our album reviews on this Friday evening. New albums. Well, from two music icons, we have a remix from one music icon and an album of covers from another. Two artists delivering distinctive sounds in the world of rock alongside them. So we have a full four to get through over the next half hour or so. The much anticipated release of one of Madonna's most groundbreaking albums, Ray of Light, which remixed original tracks and even long lost songs. Originally released in 1998, her seventh album, that was Ray of Light, redefined her as an artist. But now we're getting an album called Veronica Electronica, from her kind of alter ego type of character. Are the songs different? Is it just messy little remixes? We'll find out shortly. We'll also be talking about Paul Weller with a host of covers. He's done this before, obviously, but he's going to give us a few more here, including one of Christy Moore's songs, which is quite interesting. And then we have brand new work from We Are Scientists and Jade Bird. Zara Hederman, John Mayer with me in studio this evening. Let's cut to the chase. Is the Madonna album an album of remixes to make money, or is the Madonna album an actual album of remixes where it's worth listening to the original material and then listening to the remixes? John Mayer.
Yeah, it's definitely an album that would have made more money had it been released when it was originally planned to be released, which was 1998.
Yeah, so you have to say, why didn't she do it then?
Well, the reason was Ray of Light was a complete reinvention for her, a very successful reinvention, and she takes on board rave and techno and superstar DJs and does it spectacularly well. And that album was selling so well that they thought, let's not bring out a remix album because we might stymie the sales of not just the album but the various singles from it. So she's waited a very long time to bring out this album. In fact, to a time where sales simply aren't what they were. But it is an intriguing album. It is a remix album, and I think most people, if they want to hear this album, will want to go back to the parent original album as well.
Yeah, well, I found myself doing precisely that today with, and we'll talk about the original the title track Ray of Light from the original album in a minute. But what we're getting here then, Sarah, it's not remixes made in 2025. These are the remixes that were made back in the 1990s at the time of Ray of Light. So, and to be fair, at that time, perhaps a remix was actually a remix. It was a total reworking of the song.
Absolutely. And I think as well, there was such a culture in 1998 and into the 2000s of when you'd get a single and the B-side would tend to be the remix, or there'd be three different remixes sometimes. What I found quite interesting about this, and here we have obviously Willie Morbit, Patrick Leonard, Marius De Vries, Sasha, who are were producers on that album, and they're doing their remixes here. I wondered why was this necessary, and I was shocked that it was shelved because of the success, but actually listening to it, I appreciated how it highlighted certain elements of the original track that maybe, obviously I loved them from before, but you kind of give them a second listen and they become more prominent.
All right, well, let us listen to what was the title track on the first album, still called Ray of Light, on the second album here. And it started with a lovely gentle guitar originally. Not on this one. There you go. That is Ray of Light, as heard on the new version of that album, Veronica Electronica. And I was saying as we were listening to that, John, I mean, there is an introduction to that on this new album of about, I think it's a minute and 40 seconds or something. It's almost 2 minutes. But that was back in the day. You heard, you know, that big long introduction with Sarn, and it was a floor filler. That was what the purpose of that long introduction was. Get people out on the floor. And this album is much more of a, certainly on that track, it's much more of a banger and a floor filler than the original Ray of Light.
Yeah, I suppose it's dispensed with some of the subtleties that were on the original album, and it's kind of just more in your face. And in a way, the original album was about both Madonna and William Orbit working together, whereas a remix album, I suppose, are these significant DJ saying, this is my impact here. And they're really making themselves felt. And in that case, it's Sasha who's going, I'm here and I'm taking this and I'm reinventing it, which I suppose that's what we want from a really good remix.
And because I was approaching this with a lot of skepticism, I thought, why was it held back, you know, 20 plus, 25 plus years ago? Yes, the story was, oh, they didn't want to wreck the sales of the original, because the original album sales were extraordinary, Zara.
Yeah, no, in it, even before it sold, it had sold millions and millions of copies.
Pre-sales, yeah.
Yeah, it sold 3 million copies in 5 days. It sold 2.5 million units before it even had sold. And today it's over 16 million copies. And it's one of the best-selling albums from a female artist. And then, you know, it also, with Ray Light's legacy, it was the first album that got her musical recognition at the Grammys. So she won about 4 Grammys for this as well. And we also just see the legacy of it, of how it's like influenced, you know, the likes of Charlie XCX, Addison Rae, all that kind of stuff. But what I loved as well reading about this album was the concept behind it and Veronica Electronica.
Yeah.
And how Veronica is a medieval woman who goes to a trippy dance set, like DJ set. So that's why we have like Ray of Light.
Which,
so,
you know, is kind of, and Madonna said this herself, she said, that's what I am. I am both of those things.
And absolutely. And it, like, the pacing of the album works really well in that there's the high energy at the start, like the Ray of Light. But then as the album goes on to like Frozen or The Power of Goodbye, they're a lot more stripped back. And that is when I think the character of Veronica, she's put into a trance by her own music.
Let's have a listen. Frozen was another of the huge hits at the time, wasn't it? Let's have a listen to a little bit of Frozen. There you go. Talking about slow sets as we're listening to that, which dates me enormously, I have to say. But there you have Frozen from the remix version. Well, it's not the remix version of Ray of Light. It is from Veronica Electronica, which is a remix version of the songs on Ray of Light. Are there any... Sorry, John, you wanted to say something about Frozen, first of all.
Well, I've always felt that Frozen was one of her very best vocal performances back in the original and in this. Her voice sounds incredible. And it's worth remembering that a couple of years beforehand, she made Evita, the Alan Parker film. She took a lot of singing lessons and it pays off beautifully on that song. Yeah. And actually, the remix, all it does, it kind of really gives a sense of how great her voice was on that track.
So just briefly, is there any totally original material on this? I think most of it we've heard somewhere before, haven't we?
Yeah. Gone 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 is a new song which was originally recorded for the Ray of Light album, and it appears here in its original form.
Yeah, the original demo.
Yeah, and in some respects it's kind of hard to work out why she didn't put it on. Perhaps there was a sense that it lacked it wasn't maybe as cohesive as some of the rest of the songs, but it works quite well here.
Stars from you, John.
3 from me. I think there are some moments that feel quite samey on this, I have to say. But for Madonna fans, it's a must listen.
And is it only for completists in that respect, Zara? You know, I find myself saying, I want to listen to the remix song and the original song, not the remix album and then the original album. I want to kind of listen to it song by song to really see.
Well, I think it works because, like, for younger generations who maybe aren't aware of it and are hearing about it, it will bring them to it. I did appreciate, like what John was saying, like her vocals are so incredible and the space within the arrangements affords that. So for me, it was a 3 because I thought it was really good and also just brought me back to Ray of Light, which is great.
All right, start. 3. Oh, sorry, beg your pardon, 3, you said that. All right, let us move on then to New York City's We Are Scientists, infectious indie rock and a new album. 20 years, believe it or not, since the band with founder members Keith Murray and Chris Kane became popular on the alternative rock scene with their classic debut, which was With Love and Squalor. Zara, how important were they and have they maintained that importance throughout the intervening 2 decades? Yeah, there's a grimace.
They were really important, especially to a 13-year-old me back in the day with my Walkman. I had With Love and Squalor probably worn out. And they were huge, even though they're from New York from California, based in New York. They were massive in the UK, and especially with the NME music scene. Like, they toured quite a lot with Arctic Monkeys, Maximo Park and Editors. And then as I was going through their discography, like, I was shocked to see that they were still releasing music, and this was their 9th one, because I quickly dropped off in 2010. Where the quality just went away. They also just seemed to go away as well. And actually, when you revisit some of the albums and this one as well, like, they actually maintained their kind of magic that they had from the start.
All right. I'm sure they, if they were listening, would say the title of this song to you. Please don't say it. But you have just said it. It sounds as if it's a little bit mediocre in that respect from you. Let's have a listen to that. You're gonna love this, I'm sure. This song. Then you should tell me, breathe. Please Don't Say It, the title of that track from We Are Scientists. And Qualifying Miles is the title of the album, which I suppose is a reference to the number of trips they've been making down to the album selling studio and the album making studio, John Mayer. It was a blog today, I think it was, that I came across, and it was a fella saying, rock is not dead, guitar rock is not dead, because We Are Scientists certainly are keeping it alive here. But it is guitar-led music here. That's what we're getting, which isn't as fashionable as it used to be, is it?
No, but it's coming back. I mean, if you look at Fontaines, really bringing it back. I really like this track, partly because it just brings me back to the mid-noughties.
Oh, I hear a big butt coming.
You know? The butt, I suppose, is that it's just a band that are revisiting their past. Mm. They're not doing anything new. But it also reminded me of a band that some listeners will remember them, The Bravery. They had a huge song called An Honest Mistake, and they were kind of, the video was everywhere for a while. And it's that kind of strident, very kind of populist, enjoyable, not particularly earth-shattering sound, but I mean, I really like it. I mean, it appeals to a very base level within me in terms of get that kind of early 2000s indie music. Yeah. And yeah, it's good.
Stars.
It's 3.5 from me. Yeah. I think there were some good songs in this, a little bit that fades away as well. But I'd like to see them live. I had forgotten about this band.
Oh, there you go.
So they're back in my mind.
Zara?
Again, I was really shocked, and I loved some of the harmonies on this. I thought it was really well paced, really well arranged and produced. Okay. And I also liked how they were kind of self-deprecating. So for me, it was 3 because I kind of want the lads to win.
You want the lads to win. Qualifying Miles from We Are Scientists. We'll be back with Paul Weller after these. All right, Zara Hederman and John Mayer are still with me. We're moving on to Paul Weller's new album, RT Radio 1's album of the week, taking everyone by surprise, I'm told. It's a collection of cover versions of tracks that have personal meaning for him or that he simply likes. And I suppose if you're Paul Weller, you can make an album of tracks like that. Find El Dorado is the title of the album. So El Dorado, the song, is not quite the title track, but it's the almost title track. From Find El Dorado, new Paul Weller album, 14 cover versions of various songs. We were saying, Zara, first of all, I'm glad to see you're not crying. You told me you were crying earlier listening to this. Is that because of Eamon Friel? It's his song.
Yeah.
It is a lovely song,
it's
it has
gorgeous,
to be said.
It's gorgeous, yeah. It was the whole, the story, the interpretation. So Eamon Friel's from Derry. He passed away in 2019. And he was a former teacher and also had a music radio show as well. And it was just a song that Weller had been passed on by a friend. And it featured in a film in 1986. And he just loved it. And he went to Derry to get permission from Eamon Friel. Frail's wife and son. Yeah, and I just think the treatment of the song is gorgeous. And as we were saying, Noel Gallagher plays guitar on it as well. And that, it's just the sensitivity to it, the space in it. It's not like overdone. It's not overproduced. Yeah. And his voice sounds great in it.
I have to, because again, when I saw the Madonna remixes, I thought, yeah, well, now we'll see.
Yeah,
with this one, I heard an album cover. But no, what you want from a cover album is that you hear something of the artist who's doing the covering, you hear them, and you hear the song. You hear the song that was there that you may or may not know, but you hear it in a new way if you haven't heard it, if you know the song.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think another kind of really important thing for a covers album is that it's not just very well-known songs that we just are all kind of bored hearing.
Songs that somebody likes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, with the exception of I Start a Joke, the Bee Gees song, most of these are very obscure. And actually, when I saw the track listing and I saw El Dorado, I assumed it was the ELO song from the mid-70s, but it's not. It, as Zara said, it's really beautiful. And there are so many moments on this album that are really intimate like that. His voice just shines. He's a 67-year-old who has been, I suppose, celebrated for half a century. And a lot of it is about looking back, and it's taking stock, and it's doing it in a non-cliched way, and the choice of songs are really good, and I was very moved by it.
Yeah. And the Christy Moore song, or the song that we know from Christy Moore, One Last Cold Kiss, let's have a listen to a bit of that. That is One Last Cold Kiss, a song that many people know from the Christy Moore version. And I wondered whether, I thought it might have been a bouzouki at the top, but John was quickly online and found out first.
I did. It is Steve Craddock of Ocean Colour Scene who is playing mandolin there. And also, he is the producer of the album. So significant kudos to him for just drawing this out of Weller.
And that's another, it's 14 songs. And again, when I see
15.
Or is it 15? Maybe. Yeah. You know, when I see anything over the 12, you kind of go, you want to be earning this. But I didn't feel I was listening to it for too long, Zara.
Yeah, because it's 55 minutes as well. But like, it goes by really nicely because everything is really well cared for. And there's a few songs that are like 5 minutes long, 4 minutes long. And also with the Christy Moore One Cold Kiss, there's a great Irish interest in it as well because it opens...
The female vocalist. Do you know who the female vocalist is for?
It's Amelia Coburn.
Yeah.
But
it's too far into the track for us to play.
But the other Irish interest is the album opens really beautifully with Handouts in the Rain, which features Declan O'Rourke.
Yeah.
And that was a moment on the album that I just loved. And as well with Paul Weller, I think he's just such a fascinating character and how he's so like socially minded as well. And like how he's picked the songs, like listening to Handouts in the Rain in a 2025 context as well, I felt was very moving.
Yeah, because it's very much a song about people who are lost and who need the handouts.
Absolutely.
Who are sitting on the side of the road in the rain begging.
Yeah, and I loved that, like how he was able to bring songs from all different eras and genres and make them just feel so poignant today. And even then, like later on, like it was great hearing like Nobody's Fool, a Kinks original. And what he does as well,
it sounds like a Beatles song.
Exactly. Yeah. No, but it's great how he keeps some of the DNA of the songs but really gives it his own flair.
And there's lots of things. There's kind of swampy Delta blues type of thing on here, John. There's a lot of country sounds
And
then that folky sound that we got, and a bit of Beatles in there too. So,
and yet it hangs together extremely
well. It's
Paul
Weller,
and it is. And he's aided and abetted by some very talented people. Zara mentions Declan O'Rourke there. They've had a connection together for several years.
Yeah.
Himself and Weller, but Robert Plant turns up here. He's duetting on Clive's song from the Scottish folky Hamish Imlach, and Noel Gallagher, who of course everybody will be talking about him in a few weeks in Dublin, is present too. He plays a guitar on the title track.
All right.
It just works very well.
Stars from you, John.
It's a very solid four for me.
It's a very good
album.
And from you, Zara?
It's a four for me because I really loved it, but it also got me to listen to Lal and Mike Watterson's album where he takes the song Never the Same. So that was a nice discovery.
And that's
discovery.
A lovely version.
It was beautiful,
version of that song. All right, so it was a solid three for me. Is that what you said, Zara?
Four.
Oh, four, beg your pardon. I'm not listening properly at all. So that is Paul Weller, Find Eldorado. Don't be put off by the fact that it's an album of covers. It really does work. One final album that we're going to listen to is from Jid Bird. Who wants to talk about love? I'm sure we all do, Jid. Let's have a listen to a song called Dreams. Dreams can only break your heart. Ah, poor old, what's her name, Jid Bird. She's singing, this is her third album, Zara, and she's singing about heartbreak and all of the
terrible
ensuing
time.
Pain. You'll get
it's
through
a terrible
it, Jid. Don't
time,
worry.
Yeah.
She's been. Has she been having a tough time, or do we know?
She broke up with her fiance, Sean.
Well, that's never a good thing.
So not a great time at all. And that as well is kind of one of the more upbeat moments on it. You might think of Bruce Springsteen.
She's still hurting.
She's still hurting. It sounds quite like a Bruce Springsteen. But what this reminds me of, and my issue kind of with this album, was it's just a bit 2013. It's very much taken from the Taylor Swift Speak Now Red kind of writing of heartbreak. And you'd be forgiven for thinking that Jid Bird was from like Nashville or Austin. She's actually from London.
Yeah.
And she came up through the Brit School, which obviously gave us FK Twigs, Adele, Amy Winehouse. And I think that training and early training has really stood to her in how she brings hooks into this.
Yeah.
Like there are some really nice melodic moments, and her raspy vocal is probably the most captivating part of it. I wasn't completely sold on everything on this, but a worthwhile introduction.
A worthwhile introduction. Now, we should be clear on this one. It's not that John Mayer doesn't want to talk about love. It's just that you hadn't got this album in time for reviewing.
Based on what we've listened to so far, I'd be semi-reluctant to go and investigate, but
I'll be asking you next time you're on. What did you think of the Jid Bird? So I do not have to ask you for stars, but in terms of a title, John, you might like, if you want to talk about love as a title, what do you think of that, stars?
Well, on a star front, it's sitting in the Friends tree.
That's for the title, let's be clear. John hasn't listened to the album. Starts from you for the album itself, Sarah.
Well, even listening to it, it's still a three, and it's still a very sitting on the fence. As I said, it's a fine introduction. Her voice is great, but it's nothing I haven't heard before.
All right, Jade Bird, who wants to talk about Love, Paul Weller's Find El Dorado, We Are Science's Qualifying Miles, and Madonna's Veronica Electronica are the four albums, well, three and a half albums if you count, if we try to work that out, that Zara Hedeman and John Maher have been speaking to us about. And that is our lot for this Friday evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Liam Mullen was on sound this evening, and this evening's programme was produced by Deirdre Neeline. I will be back with you Monday at 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.